You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Today we're going to be talking about a weed killer called Roundup, which its manufacturer, Monsanto, has always maintained is as safe as table salt. But the evidence tells a different story. Carrie Gillum, investigative journalist who's written a major expose on Monsanto, joins us in just a minute. The Santa Fe Institute's Community Lecture Series brings leading thinkers to Santa Fe to explore profound questions. Why do some societies enforce monogamous marriage while the majority allow polygyny? How does inheritance vary from one society to the next? Tuesday, April 16th at 7:30 p.m., anthropologist Laura Fortunato will discuss how human social behavior evolves. Reserve your free seat at ticketssantafe.org. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Carrie Gillum. She's an award-winning journalist. She worked for many years with Reuters International News Service. She's currently research director for U.S. Right to Know, which is a nonprofit that looks at issues about our food system. And she's author of the book Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you were a Reuters correspondent for years, and at a certain point you started covering food and agriculture. At first you were a fan of industrial agriculture and Monsanto, and even Roundup, the weed killer that they manufacture. How did you come to question the safety of glyphosate, which is the main chemical in Roundup?
Well, as any journalist does, I mean, it was my job to find the facts, you know, report on this company and other companies in the agricultural sector. Reuters assigned me in 1998 to cover food and ag. I didn't know anything about it. I had a big, you know, jug of Roundup in my garage that I would use in my yard to spray for weeds and things like that. GMOs were kind of a new thing. I didn't know anything about them. I didn't worry about them, really. But then it became my job to, you know, follow the science and talk to farmers and talk to agronomists and spend time inside Monsanto's headquarters and meet with officials at Dow and DuPont and Syngenta and others. So I came to really be deeply rooted in this business and to, I had to understand it, you know, from the ground up, no pun intended, or maybe pun is intended. So, you know, it's just an evolution of knowledge. And you know, the companies are obviously always trying to sell their products, and they trumpet the rewards and the propaganda. But it became pretty clear within just a few years that what was happening on the ground and what the science was showing us didn't match up with what Monsanto and the other companies were saying about their seeds and their chemicals.
And one of the things that became clear was that there were a lot of illnesses that were being contracted by people who had a lot of exposure to glyphosate. What are some of those illnesses that are most common for people with a lot of exposure, and who's most at risk?
Right. And glyphosate, if your listeners aren't familiar with that, it's the key ingredient in Roundup. It's a weed killing substance that Monsanto patented in 1974 and made it the integral source of all of its weed-killing products, Roundup and Ranger Pro and other brand names. And it's now off-patent, so it's now used by other companies in hundreds of weed-killing products around the world. But the dangers associated with it, there are a host of environmental dangers, but people who are exposed to it, the science has shown sort of an array of different health impacts. But the primary concern is cancer, and the primary type of cancer that is associated with exposure is non-Hodgkin lymphoma, which is actually sort of, you know, an umbrella type of blood cancer with many different ways that it can manifest in the body. So there are people who've developed tumors in their necks. And Lee Johnson, the first case to go to trial, he developed a type that manifests in the skin and developed lesions all over his body that are very, very painful. There are reproductive concerns that are tied to exposure. There have been farmers in South America who have alleged that their widespread exposure to themselves and their families led to birth defects in their children who were subsequently born after enduring exposures. So the primary reason people are so concerned about this chemical is not that it's necessarily more dangerous than others, but that it's so widely used. It's so pervasive now. Monsanto has pushed it to become the most widely used herbicide in the world. And it's found, you know, food in our water, in our soil, in our own bodies. So it's not, just to make it clear, it's not that it's the most dangerous. It's that it's the most widely used. So we're, you know, it's ubiquitous in our environment. And that's really, when you put all that together, that's a really big concern.
I mean, to the point where there's a story in your book about how some people in the parliament in the European Union decided to get themselves tested. And I think everybody who was tested had Roundup, had glyphosate in their bodies.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound like, you know, anything you want to know necessarily, but testing has been done all around the world. And it is, as I said, it's found very commonly in human urine. I've been tested. I mean, it's pretty cheap now. Companies are offering, you know, little kits. But as I said, it's in our food, it's in our water. Our U.S. Geological Survey has found traces of this weed killer in rainfall and in air samples. So this is an environmental contaminant, is what our regulators refer to it as. And it's become a part of us, a part of our bodies. And that's why it's so important that we understand, you know, the impacts that it can have.
Well, besides having impacts on ourselves, on people, and we'll get back to that, it also affects wildlife like fish and terrestrial animals and also insects like butterflies and pollinators. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, as you might expect, I mean, this is a chemical that's designed to kill, you know, living species, right? I mean, plants are living things. And it's been shown to be detrimental to aquatic life, amphibian. There are concerns about forest animals, white-tailed deer, fox, rabbit. You know, if you are exposed to this over and over again, you know, it doesn't only affect humans, but it affects animals and aquatic life. As I mentioned, the mechanism by which it interacts with our body is it's not just glyphosate alone, but in these formulated products, there are surfactants that are mixed with glyphosate, and they are really sort of a delivery agent. So if it comes in contact with the skin, you know, if you're eating it, it's going to be absorbed that much quicker into your body and into your bloodstream. And in terms of the pollinators you ask about or the butterflies, that's more a concern where young monarchs typically feed on milkweed. It's very important nourishment for them. But the widespread use of this weed killer has reduced the milkweed population substantially, and you're seeing the monarch population then drop along with that. So, you know, the concerns, as I said, they're pretty wide-ranging. They run the gamut from environmental to human health.
And there's so many ways that it can get into our bodies. I mean, through the crops we eat or through the meat of the animals who ate crops that were sprayed with it, through water, through air. I mean, as you said, it's ubiquitous.
Right, yeah. And it is found in food. Now, that's a really controversial topic, I think, and I write about that in my book. Our USDA and FDA are supposed to test foods every year for pesticide residues to see at what levels these residues, these traces of pesticides are coming in on our foods, because our government understands, even if we all don't, that farmers who use pesticides, they're going to leave traces of those pesticides in the foods we eat. And it's, you know, a very unpleasant, unappetizing truth. They were supposed to be testing for glyphosate, and they didn't for decades. I mean, this just made me crazy, because I could not understand why they would test every year thousands of foods for hundreds of different pesticides and skip this most widely used herbicide. So you know, there's a whole political thing going on there. I've gotten thousands of freedom of information documents from the FDA and the USDA, and they're finally starting to do a little bit of testing. The FDA is. The USDA is still declining to do so. But in that vacuum, consumer groups around the country and indeed around the world now have been paying for testing of a whole, you know, cereals and snacks and crackers and orange juice and beer and wine and all sorts of things. And they're finding glyphosate everywhere you turn.
And really, they're doing the job that government is supposed to do and that the regulators have sort of fallen down in their duties on doing.
Right. And I got these Freedom of Information documents that lay out a particular scenario that I just think is so infuriating and just really shows the lack of effort to protect the public. But there was an FDA chemist who decided to do some testing of glyphosate, look for glyphosate residues in honey and in oatmeal, you know, two kind of popular healthy food products. And he gathered samples from grocery store shelves of honey and tested those for glyphosate, found glyphosate at very high levels in these honey products, reported this to his supervisors. They told him, basically, don't worry about it. He then tested oatmeal products, included baby food oatmeal products, found glyphosate again, this weed killer in this baby food at pretty high levels, and tried to report that. And is very concerned. And you can see in these internal documents that he's worried about this. And the government just told him not to worry. And then what they did is they reassigned him to make sure that he would never be allowed to do any more of that testing. And that's not something the government tells us. It's not something the FDA is public about. We only know it because I had to fight for these internal agency documents. I had to sue the FDA and the EPA to get thousands of these internal records.
So, I mean, this is the thing. It's kind of a classic textbook case of corruption, and it's not just random. I mean, in the book, you tell this whole story about how Monsanto has been manipulating these regulatory agencies. How do they actually do it?
Yeah, I mean, and that's another disturbing thing. You do see when you look at the internal emails and text messages, and you know, you're talking about going away to resorts together for meetings and you know, all sorts of things. It's a very cozy, collaborative sort of relationship. Definitely not a regulator holding a stick, you know,
right,
trying to protect the public and make the company behave. There's one example that I think is, again, really alarming. There was an agency called the ATSDR, which is part of Health and Human Services, and they wanted to do a toxicity test, basically testing of the glyphosate and the products that Monsanto was selling. Monsanto did not want them to do that. And they went to the EPA and their friends in the top ranks and enlisted their help. And EPA jumped and made that review go away. And you see all that lay out in the text messages and emails back and forth. And again, it's protecting corporate profit, not protecting public health.
The IARC is the International Research Agency on Cancer, and that's part of the World Health Organization, which in turn is part of the UN. And they have studied Roundup, glyphosate, and cancer. What have they found?
Right. So this we call them IARC, International Agency for Research on Cancer. And their job is to look at different popular, widely used substances and to look at the science that's been conducted around those and to determine if they present a cancer hazard. So in 2014, they looked at glyphosate and said, this is widely used and there's a lot of science out there and we should look at all of the science and classify it, give it a classification. So that's what they did. They met in Lyon, France, and looked at years and years and years of epidemiology and toxicology, mechanistic studies that had been done by researchers around the world and published and peer-reviewed. And when they finished it all, they said the weight of evidence shows that this is a probable human carcinogen with an association to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And they put out a very long, lengthy report with all of the details of all the research. So that was sort of the first official bringing it all together from all of this independent science that had been done. Because absent that, what we've had are the regulatory agencies like EPA and those in Europe and elsewhere who have relied on not independent studies, but on Monsanto's own studies. And they have routinely found that it doesn't cause cancer. But again, they're relying on information that Monsanto gives to them.
And so this leads into this whole question of how science is manipulated. And science is supposed to be able to safeguard its integrity through peer review and other processes that are built into science to make it objective. But that doesn't always work. Talk about how Monsanto has specifically tried to tell their own story at the expense of the truth where Roundup is concerned.
Well, gosh, there are so many examples of that. The word ghostwriting, or maybe that's two words, has become associated with Monsanto because through litigation, there are now about 11,000 people suing Monsanto, alleging that they've developed non-Hodgkin lymphoma after being exposed, after using or being exposed to Roundup and other of Monsanto's herbicides. And through that litigation, Monsanto's had to turn over a lot of internal records, their own internal reports and emails and things. And so what we've seen in there is that they have a term called ghostwriting. And they talk about, we ghostwrote this scientific paper, and why don't we ghostwrite this next scientific paper? And they talk about how what that means is they do most of the work, most of the writing of these studies that find that there's no reason to be concerned about glyphosate. And then they pay outside scientists who put their names on and sign off on the documents. And so these then litter or become part of the scientific record and look like they didn't come from Monsanto. They look like they are independent. So that's one way that we know that they've been manipulating the record. And there are very specific examples. There's a reproductive study, and there are many different papers out there that we now know that they ghostwrote. But they also not only ghostwrite the literature, we've seen them paying editors at scientific journals. One editor of a journal, they wanted this editor, you know, to help them, I guess, with certain things. And so we see them paying him $400 an hour as a consultant. And he's editing this journal where then we see a series of papers appear, you know, that are of great interest to Monsanto. It just goes on and on. And we've seen them talk internally about putting together magazine articles and blogs and things that can go up on different websites. And again, the idea is to look like they come from third parties, but they'll really be written by a Monsanto PR agent or a Monsanto scientist or a marketing executive inside Monsanto. But then when they go out to the world, they carry the name of an academic somewhere, a scholar or someone, so they look like they're independent. And that's a big part of how they've been messaging the safety of their product around the world.
I find myself wondering how both the people at Monsanto who are doing this and the scientists who are allowing themselves to be manipulated in this way and the others in the journals and so on that you just talked about, how they can live with themselves. I mean, have any of them defected and become whistleblowers?
No, not really, no. And what you hear are, you know, what seem to be like excuses, but what many of them will say, and, you know, I guess I would believe them, is they believe that, you know, they believe that it's safe. They believe Monsanto's rhetoric and Monsanto's marketing and sales and propaganda. They believe the messaging. So to them, it's not a big deal if Monsanto suggested the language or put together the article for them. To them, it's not a big deal. Now, you do see some pushback in the internal documents. There was one scientist in particular who did some work for Monsanto and was paid as a consultant, but then he did push back and he said, no, what you're asking us to do is ghostwriting, and that's not ethical, and I'm not going to be a part of that. You see another scientist at one point in the history who they had hired him to support their genotoxicity defense because numerous scientists around the world were starting to show in their research that this was genotoxic, these herbicides, and Monsanto hired a consultant to fight that. And the consultant looked at the research and said, well, it looks like it's genotoxic, you know? And so Monsanto said, good grief, we got to get rid of this guy immediately. And so, yeah, I mean, there are some people who push back, and then there are others who justify it as, you know, they're not doing anything wrong because that's what they believe. So the problem, and as I lay out in the book, I think open debate and discussion is wonderful, but there needs to be truthfulness and there needs to be transparency. So if Monsanto is behind a study, if they're writing it, it needs to say that. You need to have that perspective.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, just listening to you, that the word belief even crops up in a conversation about science, which isn't about belief. It's about examining evidence.
It is, except what you learn when you go down the rabbit hole is that science is not absolute necessarily, or not all science. There are so many different perspectives, and at least I've seen this, on how to interpret epidemiology results. You know, is it statistically significant? You know, what if you do a meta-analysis and you put that all together? And what about confounding factors? And, you know, there are all of these different caveats and ways to look and think about it and to analyze whether it's toxicology or the epidemiology or the other. There are rules or scientific rules that are supposed to, scientists around the world are supposed to sort of adhere to in trying to assess data. And the EPA, even within our EPA, our Office of Research and Development, has said to our scientists who say glyphosate is safe, they say, you're not following the rules. You're not assessing this properly. So it depends on how you assess it. And Monsanto and the chemical companies have always assessed these studies and convince the regulators to assess them in ways that determine that they are safe.
Right.
Whereas the weight of the independent evidence and the independent researchers, and those are peer reviewed. So you have other scientists making sure they're following the rules. Those do show carcinogenic impacts.
So you've talked about how Monsanto manipulated regulatory agencies and science. They also have really sold a bill of goods to farmers. Talk about that.
I quote a lawyer in my book who says, you know, these companies are like drug dealers. They get these farmers hooked and then the farmers don't know what else to do and they don't know where else to turn. And I was in a conversation in a round table with a farmer the other day and I shared that anecdote and he said, that's exactly right. That's what happens. You know, when Roundup Ready crops were introduced in the 90s and these were Roundup Ready, soybean and corn and cotton and canola and sugar beet, alfalfa, crops that farmers could spray right over the top with Roundup, glyphosate-based Roundup, and the weeds would die, but the crops wouldn't because they had been genetically engineered to tolerate or be resistant to the weed killer. And what a cool thing that is, right? Because before that, farmers trying to kill weeds in their fields had to be super careful. They didn't get a drop of any sort of herbicide on their crop or their crop would die right along with the weeds. And it was very tricky and labor intensive to try to clear your fields of weeds without disturbing the soil too much. And without, I mean, there was a lot involved. So if you could just walk out there and spray over your entire field, and the weeds would die and your crops wouldn't. Well, farmers thought that was the greatest thing ever. They really did. And they did for a really long time and made Monsanto a ton of money, which was exactly what they wanted. You know, sell the seeds. It ensures more sales of their herbicides and life is great for everybody. But of course, what happened is not only is it harmful to your health to do this and to use this over and over again, but it's harmful to the environment and weeds became resistant. Weeds, you know, Mother Nature adapts and the weeds start to become resistant. We now have over 100 million acres of weeds that don't die when you spray them with these chemicals anymore. And so farmers are having to try more and more herbicides, more combinations, more strategies, spend more money. It's just become a real nightmare in farm country because what worked 20 years ago doesn't work anymore. So the chemical company solution to that is to add more chemicals on, to combine glyphosate now with dicamba or combine it with 2,4-D. So that's one of the outcomes.
It's interesting that you use the metaphor of drug dealer because in a lot of ways, that kind of like super chemical intensive agriculture, I think of it like cocaine, like it gives you a lot of energy for a while, but it's not a long-term way to have a food supply. When you're talking about farming. So you might get high yields for a while, but then you get, as you say, these super weeds, and you get damage to the soil, which in the long run is the source of all food. And when you destroy it, you're really in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, this is what scientists have shown, and this is what a lot of what I was reporting over these years at Reuters. Soil scientists, pretty early on, as glyphosate use rose and rose and rose, and we should say it was about 40 million pounds a year in the U.S. was used in the 1990s, and we're now at almost 300 million pounds a year used every year in the United States. So, you know, that's a giant increase, right? And what that has done, as you said, is not only increased weed resistance, which is creating this cycle where you want to put more and more chemicals or till the soil more, but it's impacted soil health. This glyphosate, as it builds up in the soil, is being found to destroy beneficial bacteria in the microbial community in the soil, which plants require, you know, for it to be healthy and to develop nutritiously and the way that we want our food to be. And so if plants then become less healthy and they become more vulnerable to, say, disease, so then farmers are going to use more fungicide to try to combat the disease, and maybe they're more vulnerable to insects, and so you're going to spray more insecticide. It's a vicious pesticide treadmill.
It reminds me of when somebody goes to the hospital to get something treated and they treat them with a drug that then has side effects, and then they use another drug to treat that side effect and then another one to treat the side effects of the second drug. And it's just a cycle in which the person becomes less and less healthy. In those scenarios, you're not looking at what does it take to prevent disease and have a healthy person in the first place. And it's kind of the same thing with land and soil.
Yeah, exactly. And farmers are waking up to this because of the explosion of this chemical and how it has just wreaked havoc on soil health and pollinator health. And as we talk about, butterflies are very important pollinators, bees and their honey, and bees are impacted by not only glyphosate, but a whole class of insecticides known as neonicotinoids. And we're seeing a decline in the bee population, and bees are so important for pollination of our food crops. So these techniques, this pesticide-dependent agricultural production system, is not sustainable, and farmers have realized that to a large degree. So what you're seeing is more and more in the Midwest here, I talk to a lot of them, and really different parts around the country and around the world, but adapting different techniques to try to go back to sort of more traditional things like rotating their crops more and using cover crops and doing different things that help encourage, you know, soil health and less runoff. And there are so many things that farmers have known about, but they're more hard work maybe, and you've got to think about it more and you got to be very strategic. But over the long term, the payoff is so much better for the environment and for all of us and for the food we eat. So the farmers are really wrestling with that now, you know, it's short-term gain versus long-term gain. And so they're really looking for support. They're looking for the USDA and universities and others to put research dollars into this and try to, you know, shift the paradigm to a certain degree so that we can get back to a healthier system.
Well, that's the thing. And because I do so much talking about regenerative agriculture and looking at really a whole new paradigm that involves working with nature instead of fighting against it, one of the questions that comes up a lot is scale. Like, do you think large-scale farming makes the chemical agriculture, the Roundup problem, worse? Would we be doing better if we had more small farms in terms of producing healthy food in non-toxic ways?
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems like that might be the case, right? You've had so much consolidation. And so you see all of these, you know, where farming used to have, they used to have a few hundred acres or something. And now farmers have thousands of acres, right? Spread through different counties, you know, that they're trying to manage or leasing and that sort of thing. And so to a degree, it's easier to just, you know, have corn and soy. That's what we're seeing in a lot of Midwestern row crop farmers, corn and soy. you know, or a little bit of wheat rotated in there, you know, or barley or sorghum, but you're not seeing sort of the vertically integrated farming system where the farmer has the livestock and the livestock provides the fertilizer, manure, and you're growing a whole array of different crops and you're using cover crops and some of that can be fed back to the livestock. And, you know, this vertically integrated system that is much healthier, I think, is more in line and more adaptable by the smaller farmers. Although we're seeing movements, we're seeing people try that out on the large scale.
So let's talk about the pushback against Roundup. There are groups all over the world that have tried to regulate or outlaw the chemical. Give us some examples of people really pushing back through the legislative and regulatory process and how they have fared.
Well, they're, you know, around the country. I mean, you just saw LA County, different people in Florida, just all over the place. Irvine, California, communities, cities, school districts, Berkeley's pushing, Emory University, different places are pushing to get away from these pesticides. And people are saying, we don't want it in our parks where our kids play or on our school ball fields, you know, where everybody's rolling around. And, right. And so, you know, city councils are talking about it. And community, like neighborhoods in Florida, I've talked to people where they're trying to push to get it so it's not used around their little ponds in their neighborhoods and things. That's, you know, really what it takes to affect change, I think, is it has to be from the grassroots. It has to be from the ground up. If people care about this and they're worried about it, they have to be vocal about it. Now, you're also seeing, of course, a movement by the companies in Washington, D.C. to lobby against those local moves and trying to get some preemptive legislation passed in Washington that would make it illegal, that would bar localities from making their own decisions about whether or not to use these pesticides or ban these pesticides.
There's also been a lot of court cases. There are people, and I know you're following this very closely, who have gone to court seeking damages against Monsanto. You've met many people who've gotten sick after exposure, families of people who've died. Tell us about those cases. What are the courts saying so far?
Yes, I mean, there are a lot of plaintiffs, as I said, about 11,000 so far, and I've met many of them. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking always. You know, there are some who are suing on behalf of their lost husband or wife who's already died from the disease. There's a trial ongoing right now in California of a husband and wife who both have non-Hodgkin lymphoma, who both used Roundup fairly extensively in their retirement. They had numerous properties together that they owned and acquired and were trying to landscape and clear and keep up. And they both have developed this in their 70s. And, you know, Lee Johnson, he was the very first to go to trial last summer in San Francisco. And he has this terrible cancer all over his body, the skin cancer that manifests on the skin, the lesions that are so painful. And I've spent time with him and his wife, and he's not expected to live very long. So it has real impacts on real people all over. I get emails almost every week from people who say, I have this non-Hodgkin lymphoma. You know, I think it's because I used Roundup. And it's sad.
Are the courts agreeing with them?
Well, so far, we've only had two trials conclude, and in both trials, different juries have found for the plaintiffs. The first one for Lee, you know, they awarded $289 million, and that included $250 million of punitive because they found that Monsanto was malicious and acted so badly. It's not only did Roundup cause cancer that the juries are facing in these trials, but it's did Monsanto know that that risk was there, and did they fail to warn about the risk? Did they actively try to hide the risks of these products? That's where the juries are finding, yes, the internal records, the internal emails and communications show very clearly that they had ample information about these risks and did everything they could to hide them. So you had that giant verdict. Now the judge in that case in San Francisco reduced that verdict to $78 million. She thought $289 million was crazy. And Monsanto's appealed it, so Lee Johnson hadn't gotten any money, and he's still dying. And the second trial, which concluded just recently here in March, they found, again, for the plaintiffs and awarded $80 million. So, you know, the juries are certainly convinced. Now, Monsanto and Bayer, Bayer just bought Monsanto last year. They continue to argue that the juries are crazy. They don't know what they're talking about. All the scientists are crazy. The International Agency for Research on Cancer doesn't know what it's talking about. And everybody's wrong, except for people who side with them.
Well, and one of the most recent pieces of news is the discovery that Monsanto put aside $17 million to discredit cancer research.
Yeah. That came out. Yes, I just reported that a couple of weeks ago. That came out in one of the depositions of Monsanto's marketing agents, one of their top guys in charge of marketing and outreach. And they asked him, what have you guys been doing to try to counter these international scientists, because you're trying to discredit them and you're saying they're wrong? And he said, he confirmed that they had budgeted about $17 million in just 1 year alone in 2016 to try to discredit the International Agency for Research on Cancer. Now, he didn't say, he doesn't term it as discrediting. He terms it as, you know, sort of correcting the record, that those scientists are wrong and that Monsanto needed to counter that message through, you know, a whole array of different projects. But that's a lot of money. And the plaintiff's attorneys pointed out to him, you know, gosh, couldn't you have spent some of that money? I mean, you could have done a lot of cancer testing on your product for that $17 million.
Right.
But you didn't do it.
Well, it's such a textbook example of privatizing profits and socializing costs. So this is, I mean, you have this chapter in your book on Argentina, and there's so many people in the United States and really everywhere where people get sick, there are birth defects, there's miscarriages, there's the death of children, there's cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and all the costs of that, financial and social and emotional, fall on individuals, on communities, on their governments. But the profit is reaped by Monsanto and Monsanto only, and they don't give back.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I tried to just make that point recently in a Guardian piece, that they're reaping billions of dollars in profit, but the true price of all of this is paid by all of us who are sick and by our children who are going to inherit this, you know, contaminated environment and who are losing IQ points because of their exposure to these different toxins. Our National Toxicology Program put out a report in 2016, and they've since increased their warnings. They did it again in 2017, but they're saying we are just awash in these chemicals and these environmental pollutants, including these pesticides, and they are doing just what you said. They are eroding, you know, the health of our future generations. People are suffering from cancers and other diseases and reproductive problems. And it's costing us, and not only in blood and tears, but in our economic base. You know, if our people are less smart and our people are less healthy, it does impact our overall economy. So I guess if all you care about are dollars, you know, there's still a reason to care about this.
We are, I think, in kind of a dark age right now where public safety is concerned, and this story is, you know, it's the story of what happens when government fails to protect its own citizens and instead becomes corrupted by power and money. I mean, it's just, I feel like a walking cliche when I say that, but that's the story. You see it in so many different, we saw it in the tobacco industry. We saw it in DDT. You know, they're just, you know, generation after generation, this story is retold with kind of different players, but it's the same story. That said, what do you think good policy would look like that protects not only people and wildlife, but the food system itself?
I think at the root of all of it is we have to get the money out of Washington. I just think we do. I think we cannot have a system that is run so blatantly by corporate interests. I mean, it's just become the norm. It's just become something that we accept as normal. But it's corrupted the system to such a degree now that we don't have, it seems like we have almost no balance whatsoever. the lawmakers rely on the campaign contributions, and the lawmakers are the ones in the administration who appoint the heads of our regulatory agencies, and they are the ones who determine whether or not they're going to overrule their own internal scientists. You have a lot of really good public citizens, public workers inside these agencies who are trying to do their jobs, you know, like this FDA chemist, and there are scientists within the EPA that I talk about in my book who are trying so hard to do their jobs, and within the CDC and ATSDR and national, and they just continually get smashed down because they are running into conflict with big corporations, big corporate power. And if we didn't have a system where corporate money was allowed to hold sway in Washington, maybe things could start to change. But I really think that's the first hurdle we have to somehow overcome.
Right. You've devoted many years to bringing this story to light and are still doing so. How do you think the media as a whole have done in addressing the issue of toxicity, and specifically the toxicity of the weed killer Roundup?
Well, I mean, until very recently, you know, I was sort of the lone voice in the wilderness, I guess. I mean, I look back and, you know, I was writing about cancer science and Roundup and glyphosate back in 2009 and 10 and 11 and that sort of thing. And again, I was about the only one. And, you know, even when my book came out in 2017, a lot of people were like, "You're crazy. There is no, that is just crazy." And to me, it's so crazy that people haven't gotten it. I mean, there have been studies all over the world that have shown these problems associated with this chemical. But now people are paying attention, right? And now you've got Bloomberg and New York Times and Wall Street Journal and LA Times and all these European news outlets, and the whole world is watching now because of litigation. So, you know, that's a good thing. I do think it's important to point out, and I do this in my book, and like everybody understand, I don't think Monsanto and its Roundup are the worst things on the planet. I don't think that Roundup is the most dangerous pesticide out there. But I do think that it is the poster child for the much bigger, much more important problem of pesticide dependence, pesticide prevalence. When we set up a system where we allow a handful of companies to tell us that it's okay that we have insecticide and fungicide and herbicide in our water, in our food, in our bodies, in our air, and it's fine to feed it to our kids, and it's fine that our soil is being degraded and our water is polluted, that's a big problem. And I think these trials and this Roundup situation is sort of a wake-up call, and I'm hoping the bigger message gets out there.
If somebody's listening right now, what would you recommend? I mean, should everybody get tested? Should they find out if their municipalities, if they live in a town or city, are using it? I mean, what can individuals do?
Well, I think it depends on who you are, where you live, right? What's happening? So, for instance, my brother and his wife and two little children live next to a farm field. Now, they don't farm, but the guy next to him does, and he does a lot of aerial spraying, and they're very concerned. Right? So they need to know. They need to find out, what is he spraying? You know, what is it? Is he spraying legally? You know, is he doing it when he can? Or, you know, if the wind is blowing, maybe you don't want to put the kids outside right after an aerial spray, or definitely not during an aerial spray. I mean, you want to be aware of these things. If you're feeding your kids, you want to know what's in the food that you're feeding them. I know, for instance, from reading our FDA and USDA giant reports every year, strawberries, a bowl of strawberries can carry the traces of 20 different pesticides.
Right.
So I make sure I buy organic strawberries. A lot of people want to, if you have the means, a lot of people like to grow their own fruits and vegetables if they can. A lot of people like to support and befriend local farmers so they can have conversations and know kind of how their food is being grown. I mean, I think it just depends on where you are in your place in the world. You know, if you're older, if you have children, I know some people just say, "I don't care. I don't care. I'm more worried about global warming, so I'm not going to worry about pesticides." So it's an individual decision. But if you don't have the information, you don't have accurate, truthful information, you can't make good decisions for yourselves and your families.
Gary Gillum is author of the book Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the Lanl Foundation for their support.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.